Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Blair Braverman's inner compass points north, way north. She tells us in the first sentence of her new memoir, "I've spent more than half my life pointed northward, trying to answer private questions about violence and belonging and cold." Today, a discussion about what she wanted and what she found in the great wide north. And there's a concept I have to bring you in on because, let's admit it, many of us are north-loving kind of people around here. So I want to hear from you if you've ever been way, way, way north. Was it an experience that revealed something essential to you about yourself? And I think Blair and I would especially like to hear from women as you tell us about where you went and what you discovered. So if you're somebody that just loves the way, way, way north, tell me about your experiences there. And women, I want to hear from you this hour about going north, what the culture is like there, what you learned about yourself. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, of course, at Carrie NPR. Blair Braverman's new memoir is titled, "Welcome to the GD Ice Cube, Chasing Fear and Finding Home in the Great White North," and she's with us from Madison. Blair, welcome to the show. It's good to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I think if you travel a bit and you're receptive to new experiences in the world, you find a place where you're your best self. And I got the sense that that's something that you were aware of and that you ultimately discovered. Is it fair to say?
I think so. You know, I think that when I first went north, I was looking for a place where I could become the person that I wanted to be, which was this sort of tough, adventurous, competent, self-sufficient woman that I was growing into, because I really went up to the Arctic first as a teenager. And that was sort of my rebellion.
You know, I think you used the word tough just now, and I feel like there's this assumption that women, and I really hope we hear from some women today, that women have to be made of sterner stuff to thrive in these extreme environments. But, you know, I've talked to explorer Anne Bancroft a number of times, and when she talks about what it is to persevere in an environment like that, she doesn't talk about, "and I'm tough and it's, you know, it's hard to knock me down." She talks about clarity and steadfastness and strategy. I think in a way that's what you were demonstrating too as you told this story. What do you think of that?
Well, thank you. I think she's probably a braver person than me.
Really?
I think that when I went up to try to be tough, it was because I felt like a very fearful person, and I was trying to demonstrate that I wasn't governed by that fear. I don't like adrenaline. I am not a thrill seeker. And yet I spend so much time out in 40 below, you know, crossing wilderness alone with these dogs. So for me, it was an attempt to negotiate all those anxieties.
I don't think I believe that you're not a thrill seeker. Why is that something that you feel you have to say? Everything you've done would say something opposite, you know?
That's a good question. I think that when I'm with other mushers and when I'm with other people who live lifestyles like the lifestyle I live, I am always aware of the ways that the things that excite them are things that, you know, put a rock in my stomach, yeah, terrify
but,
me.
But wait. Blair, even if you are anxious about, you know, that's natural. Even if you're anxious about, you know, what you're about to take on, does not mean that you aren't a thrill seeker. It just means that, you know, you're a little anxious about it.
I guess so. I don't believe you, but that's nice to hear.
Maybe I don't believe you. Maybe that's where we are.
Okay. Now that we've started this conversation,
yeah, isn't that a great way to start?
Mistrust.
That's right. Let me grab a call here from Janice in Foley. Hey, Janice, hi. What's your experience of going north?
Oh, I was a nurse, I still am, back in the 1980s, and I got a random invite, "Would you like to go up to an Eskimo village for the summer?" I said, what the heck? Why not? Let's do it. And I ended up in Kotzebue, Alaska, north of the Arctic Circle. My husband swears he met me that night. I don't have the same memory. It seems to me it was a few days later. But it completely changed my life. It grounded who I was with the outdoors. I am still an outdoors woman. I brought sled dogs back. I ran sled dogs for 20 years. Oh. I ran a business for women and girls to teach them how to drive dog teams. I canoe, I kayak, I hike. And to this day, 30-plus years later of our being together, if we need to just reground ourselves, we go camping.
Jeez.
And in remote places, by the way. Our favorite camping spots are like remote West Texas and southern New Mexico, you know, places where there aren't other people, because that just is where we feel fulfilled.
Janice, I'm so glad you heard this conversation. And I think you need to make the acquaintance of Blair, because you two.
Janice, do we know each other?
We need to meet.
I know. Are you in Minneapolis?
I'm in Foley, which is on outskirts of St. Cloud.
Okay. We'll cross paths, I'm sure.
I know, at some point. So did you recognize the name of that village in Alaska that Janice was in?
Yes, although most of my experience has been up in northern Norway, actually.
Right.
So my experience with the Canadian and Alaskan Arctic is pretty thin.
How do you think it differs, though, with those two way, way, way north locations?
I think the cultures are completely different. The other thing is that Norway is a lot warmer in the Arctic because it has the Gulf Stream. So, you know, the place that I lived in Norway is farther north than like 95% of Alaska,
Jeez.
But also more livable than like 95% of Alaska.
Livable because it's not so cold.
It is. You know, it'll be like 60 for a couple months in the summer and then 20 to 30 for most of the winter.
Now let's
20 to 30 below, I mean.
Yeah, yeah. Below. I think we all understood that. Yeah. This isn't California, Blair. We get that.
Okay. Yes, I know.
You know, this kind of goes back to what we were talking about before, where we were saying that, you know, you didn't set out. You like the idea of kind of being a tough girl, but you're not a thrill seeker. You're not out there just for the thrills. I felt like the memoir, you were telling me in some ways, yes, I wanted to lead an exceptional and adventurous life, but I'm not going to lie about the fact that it was dangerous and trying in ways mm-hmm. that sound pretty familiar. You know, it sound familiar to a lot of women. I mean, you encountered the stuff that I might not have thought about, but that I fully expected when I, as a woman, in these places. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yes, I sure do. I think that when you say that, what you said earlier about women who go up on the frontier, who go up north needing to be of tougher stuff or having exceptional grit, I think that that is true. It takes more out of women than men, and that's not because of the landscape. It's because that those communities are very male-dominated in many cases, and, you know, there's not a lot of oversight. There's a lot of sexism up there in a way that's very familiar to people from their workplaces or their schools or their families.
Yeah, you don't have to go up near the Arctic Circle to encounter that, and yet, I mean, you were being exposed to, I don't know, the essence of a kind of masculinity,
mm-hmm.
weren't you? How comfortable were you with that?
Not at all. And I found myself trying to imitate that masculinity as much as I could in an effort to fit in. This wasn't the case in Norway, but when I worked in Alaska, my first day off being a dog sled guide, I immediately went to the Salvation Army and I bought all men's clothes so that people would, you know, maybe take me a little bit more seriously. And it, unfortunately, it worked. So there were these ways that I was sort of, you know, in some cases dating people I didn't want to date because it gave me an in. It gave me protection from harassment by even more people, that kind of negotiation. And I also think to a degree that to survive in an extreme landscape, you have to be disconnected from your body. you have to sort of accept a certain level of discomfort. And for me, at least, that translated into probably doing the same thing to a dangerous degree in terms of sexual harassment, in some cases abuse, just sort of telling myself I had to shut down my body in order to get through it. And that's what the landscape took.
So what I wondered about when I read about that day that you went to the Salvation Army and you bought all these men's clothes was, mm-hmm. I mean, you weren't disguising the fact that you were a woman. And when you say you wanted to be taken more seriously, I got the sense that there was more to it. I mean, you wanted to make sure that your femininity, even though it was going to be impossible to shed that in this landscape, was something that people thought about much later. That it wasn't the thing that you led with, right, in your interactions. But that's almost impossible in an environment like that.
It did feel like the first thing people thought when they saw me was, this is a female musher. And also, I was very young. So I wasn't just a dog sledder, a dog sled guide. Even the tourists would sort of be taken aback. And there's a lot of really incredible female mushers. But it doesn't mean that there's as many as there are male mushers, or that people aren't still surprised to see them.
You know, there were times that you put yourself in danger in places that I got the sense that you didn't really realize that you were in danger. And I'm thinking of like that fireside camp. Was this in Norway or was this in Alaska, where the two guys...
That was in a village in Norway.
In Norway, that's right. So you're at this fireside camp and you're here with two men. It's just you three, isn't it?
One of the men had his two teenage daughters there.
Okay. So, and these two guys suggest that you have sex with them so that it can be decided who's the better lover. And I'm
yes.
reading this and I'm thinking, does she know the kind of risk that she's put herself in this situation? And you seemed somewhat, I don't know, kind of oblivious, or I can handle this.
Yeah, it's interesting to me to hear readers' responses to that scene and then to other scenes with those same men, because there's a few interactions. I actually, at the time, found it incredibly refreshing because I was recovering from a more insidious kind of sexism where people were implying those same things but not saying them out loud. And what I felt permission to do in that situation, because those men said that so explicitly, and I actually never got the impression they were going to try to force me to do anything. It felt very much like a suggestion and not an appropriate suggestion that I wanted to pursue, but you know, they thought it and they brought it up, and I felt so much permission then to negotiate back with them and say, I'm not going to have sex with either of you. That's not going to happen. You can give me a hug when I arrive, but you can't have your hand on my back right now. And so I don't know if I'd seek out situations like that again. I think at the stage that I was in at that point in making sense of these experiences, it gave me a chance to sort of, the way I thought of it was like surfing the waves of an ocean that had once pulled me under, trying to, you know, track what was happening and be in control of the degree to which I would participate.
And what you mean when you say it was out there in the open in a way that some of these other more insidious experiences where people were trying to pressure you into, you know, something physical that you didn't want, or you were mm-hmm. as within this house in Norway with this host family, the father was just on the verge. You felt in, under threat a lot of the time. This mm-hmm. was something where it was open, it was out on the table, and you could freely address it in a way you couldn't in those other situations. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, definitely. I felt in some ways that the hardest thing about those other situations was not the situation or the interaction itself, but the ways that it caused me to doubt my own instincts, to fail to trust how I was interpreting what people were doing. I just questioned myself so much. And you know, that started when I was 16, so I also didn't have the context of adult relationships. So to be in a situation where there wasn't a chance to question myself, I just got to firmly state my boundaries and, you know, actually have them accepted. That felt so powerful to me and somewhat addicting.
You know, it's a very disorienting thing, isn't it? Especially at the age, as you point out, that you were in your, late teens. Mm-hmm. And not to, and I think you write about this so clearly, not to be able to say, I know this is happening. Every instinct in my body tells me this is what's happening. And yet, to the outside world, this doesn't look believable. Even to your own parents, right? As you were telling them what was going on in this home, in this with this host family, with this father.
That's right. I tried to reach out to my parents for help, and my parents are wonderful. And I know they were. Now I know they were very worried about me from at home because I was there for a year in that household, and I didn't have the ability to articulate that feeling that you're talking about, that sense that something is wrong, that something is dangerous, but because nothing had happened that I could firmly explain, I didn't trust myself to say it was wrong. I only, was able to say I didn't like this place. I didn't get along with them. I could say that I didn't feel safe, but even then I would doubt myself so much because I was taught and firmly felt that it wasn't my job as a kid, basically, to question the adults around me who were in positions of authority. And so I ended up trying to reach out for help, but because I couldn't articulate what was wrong, I wasn't able to explain that to other people.
It made me realize what an accomplished predator this father was in this family. I mean, I think it's no accident that he went right up and past the line, but he knew when to pull back. I think he knew exactly how disorienting this was for you. He knew what he was dealing with here.
I think that now, even when I went back to write the book, that was the hardest thing for me, was writing about that situation.
Really?
Because I still had so much doubt in my instincts. All I could do was see back into the mind of that 16-year-old. I couldn't relive it with my adult perspective. So I had to, you know, track down people who had witnessed interactions and interview them about what they had seen without showing my hand, just saying, hey, you know, you were there. Can you just tell me everything you remember? I tracked down emails I sent friends, emails I sent my parents, journal entries. And actually, if you look at that part of the book, it is much less scene-driven than other parts of the book. What I found myself doing, the only way I felt confident writing about it was to write about the impact it had on me, less about, you know, the moments that happened, the moments that I questioned, and more about, oh my gosh, I was 16 and I found myself practicing climbing out of my bedroom window. What brought me to that point?
He also, I mean, you suffered a kind of what I thought of as post-traumatic stress after that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you had that experience, it sounds like, of needing to adopt this vigilance that even long after you left that situation and, you know, and all the anxiety, the watchfulness that goes with that, I mean, that's something that it sounded like it took you a long time to shed. Am I overthinking this, or is that true?
No, I think to some degrees I'm still shedding it. And I think that was what felt so good to me about becoming a dog sledder, learning that sport, going into the wilderness, was that the dangers in the wilderness, I mean, they can always happen, right? I mean, I know, listeners, you're an outdoorsy place. People go outside. You never can control the weather or animals or anything like that. But whatever happens in the Arctic, in the wilderness, if there's a blizzard, if there's a polar bear, nobody means you harm. Nobody is trying to manipulate you. Nobody is setting out to hurt you. So the dangers are innocent in that way. You just have to say, okay, here's the risk and here's how I'm going to handle it. I didn't find myself questioning whether the risk was real.
I talked about the stress of that, but there's also, there's a lot of shame, which I know your readers, me among them, wish you didn't feel. You didn't have to have felt around that. Do you feel like you've let that go?
I think to a greater degree than I ever thought that I could. It was not easy to put all this in the book. Actually, when I pitched the book, I didn't have any, there wasn't sort of a sexual violence plot line. That was something that I realized as I was writing it was so deeply braided into the more, you know, quote unquote adventure stories that I couldn't fully separate them. I had to face that aspect of the story and put it in the book in order to be honest with the readers and myself. But I do feel like the things that drove me that I was so interested in, like the concept of being a tough girl and what that meant and proving myself and all these things, I now don't care about nearly to the degree that I cared about before I started writing the book. I actually, in some ways, find them boring, which I love.
Blair Braverman is with us this hour. If you've tuned in, we're talking about her memoir and a lot of the, well, as you hear, some of the surprising themes that animate the memoir that she didn't expect would come up when she began to write it. It's called Welcome to the GD Ice Cube. Yep, I'm cleaning that up a little bit. Chasing Fear and Finding Home in the Great White North. And as we talk about her experiences in some pretty inhospitable places, way, way north, I'd love to hear from you, as with Janice, if you're a woman who has had an experience up there in some of these, what many of us think of as godforsaken landscapes, way up north, and what that revealed to you about yourself, how it changed your life. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, of course, at Carrie NPR. Blair's going to read an excerpt on the other side of news, so I'll ask her to open the book and we'll set that up a little bit. But to Phil Picardi now. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Carrie. A U.S. soldier has been killed in a roadside bomb attack in Afghanistan. Another American was wounded in that attack. Just yesterday, officials said 100 more troops had been sent to the city of Lashkar Gah to help defend it. Six Afghan soldiers were also wounded in today's attack. It's the second time this year an American soldier has been killed in hostile circumstances in Afghanistan. Vice President Joe Biden is telling Baltic leaders to disregard Donald Trump's threats not to defend NATO allies. Biden has been meeting with the leaders of Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia during a visit to Latvia designed to show support to countries near Russia. He says the U.S. honors its Article 5 commitment to defend NATO allies. Biden is not using Trump's name, but he tells the leaders to take seriously, not to take seriously what they may hear from a presidential candidate. President Obama heads to southern Louisiana today, the scene of severe flooding. Obama has taken some criticism by opting to complete his vacation in Martha's Vineyard before inspecting the flood damage in Louisiana. The White House says the president is willing to face criticism about optics as long as the federal response is up to par. Traffic deaths in the U.S. were up about 9% in the first 6 months of the year compared to the same period last year. The National Safety Council estimates 19,100 people have been killed on U.S. roads from January through June. And Russia remains banned from the Paralympic Games as punishment for a state-backed doping program. The Court of Arbitration for Sport dismissed the Russian Paralympic Committee's urgent appeal against exclusion from the September Games in Rio. More news ahead on NPR News. The time is 10:42.
On Morning Edition, Kathy Werzer asks the questions that need to be answered.
When do you pull the plug on attempts to get a deal done?
Well, that's a very good question.
Tune in weekdays from 4 to 9 on Minnesota Public Radio News.
I'm Tom Weber. Next hour, looking back on 20 years of welfare reform, how Minnesota spent its federal money for the program. You'll also get an update on MLS soccer in Minnesota and why that ruling on minimum wage in Minneapolis could mean more initiatives like it in other Minnesota cities. All of that at 11.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by our members and by Pentair, the official sustainable water provider to the Minnesota Twins. You can learn more online at Pentair.com.
Two dates to put on your calendar. September 15th, it is when Talking Volumes, the season opens. Elizabeth Alexander, special guest for the end of that show, live at the Fitzgerald Theater. I am so excited for the new season to open. Gloria Steinem and Carl Hyacin, and you can find out all about the season at The Thread. And Jeffrey Toobin, writing about the Patty Hearst kidnapping with all the Minnesota connection to the Symbionese Liberation Army. This is going to be a really cool conversation. Of course, we'll talk politics because he comments on politics for CNN. But that is September 28th, and that is at the Westminster Town Hall Forum. We are so delighted to be at Westminster. I hope you'll be there, too. September 28th, tickets available at The Thread. Tickets for all the stuff I'm doing in the fall. And I'd love to see in the audience. That's all coming up, and you can check it out on The Thread. Back to the conversation this hour. Blair Braverman is with us, and we're talking about her new memoir, Welcome to the GD Ice Cube. Let me take a call here, Blair, for you, before we do the excerpt. Is that good with you?
Sure.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
To Laura in Eden Prairie. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I was really interested, as I listened to Claire's talk, the similarities between hers and Cheryl Strayed's experience in the wilderness, where the only thing that she really felt threatened by were two other human beings at one point.
Good point.
But beyond that, I really liked the point that she made about not feeling that she could go with her own instincts. And I know that when I was very young, I was similar in that you just didn't want to think badly of people. You didn't want to be judgmental. And yet I think it's so important for young people, boys included, but probably especially girls, to trust their instincts because they usually are correct. And I think when you're young, you're just so vulnerable to being taken advantage of that way.
That makes sense to you, Blair?
Absolutely.
And do you see similarities with Cheryl Strayed's book? Have you read it?
I have read it. I do, although I often don't see as many similarities as other people seem to see. Although I am always honored by the comparison. It's a great book.
Oh, so, you know, I didn't think about that when I was reading it. So other people have said this to you. Huh.
Yes.
Okay.
Almost everyone.
Really?
Yeah.
Gee, I've interviewed Cheryl Strayed about Wild, too, and it just, this felt so different to me.
You should ask her about similarities to Welcome to the GD Ice Cube.
Well, that was a couple of years ago, so to see what she says about that. To Sarah in Itasca County. Hey, Sarah, hi.
Hi.
Hi, what'd you want to say to Blair?
So thanks for sharing, Blair, and I am not much of a reader because I don't have time, but I'm super thrilled to read your book. I'll probably have to listen to it on a CD, honestly.
But oh, cool.
One of the things that prompted me to call in was I love the title of your book. It so many things of what y'all are talking about resonate with me. We just moved to Northern Itasca County about 4 years ago, and so it was a totally different context than what we were used to living in, and they bill this part of the country as the edge of the wilderness, and it takes a little bit of getting used to. And the people who live here really well, and they do a great job in the context, and we're picking up on that and getting our groove with how to live well here as well. But we've got some medical challenges with two children that were born into our family, and so similar to you, I find a parallel in that the least scary things about our life are the wilderness. And the more threatening things in our life have been how do we be vigilant about this disease that creeps up on us every week and every month, and how do we deal with setting up appropriate boundaries and how to deal with that, as well as try not to fight it, but try to roll with it, but also, you know, keep it tamed in its place, you know, and it's something we have to live with. So we've got two kids with rare issues, and we've got pediatric help that's at least an hour away, if not further. Hmm. But I just really love your book because people say, oh, aren't you afraid they'll hear about we've got bear in our yard, or, you know, the power's been out for 3 hours or something, which is rare because the Rural Electric Co-op does a great job here. But and we're like, heck no, that's not the least of our concerns.
The bears are the least of your concerns.
Right, yeah, or the freezing cold weather, or, you know, so you just, so, and I find that moving here from central Minnesota, it has taken me a little bit of time to make friends with my landscape. Like, I really was familiar with the trees and the flora and fauna in central Minnesota, and now here, they're becoming old friends here, too. And it sounds strange, but when you don't have a lot of people around, or you can be comfortable alone or with people, you find that there's a lot of life and a lot of interaction with all this green around us in the forest here. So,
Sarah, I appreciate the call. I wish you well up there in the outer beyond.
Oh, can I?
Of course.
Yeah.
Sarah, it sounds like you're our kind of people. I don't know if you're ever in northern Wisconsin, but we love taking kids and families dog sledding.
I love northern Wisconsin, yeah.
So you can write to me, and I'd love to take your family dog sledding.
Oh, we would absolutely love that. In fact, that would be something we're interested in getting into, because there's, with our one child's rare disease, it's progressive and aggressive. So as time goes on, she's going to be able to do less and less. But the medications and the management for it are getting better and better. So hopefully the decline won't be as fast as the declines have been for other kids that we know now as we're in this community.
Sarah, what we'll do is off air, we'll get your contact and we'll send it to Blair.
Yeah,
how's that?
That would be great.
Right.
And that would be something that would be totally up her alley and she could do great with. So we would love to engage her with the love of dog sledding. That would be awesome.
So, Sarah,
thank you. It's not the same thing at all, but I had Lyme disease 2 years ago, and I couldn't, I wasn't very mobile at all for that winter, so I rode in the dog sled and could just go out wrapped in a sleeping bag, so your kid can too.
Blair, will you, this is a great setup then for the excerpt, because this is your experience of one of the first times that you get out on a dog sled and you watch the way the dogs work. So tell us where you are and what part you're going to play as you're seeing kind of how this works.
Yes. So this is when I was 18 and I had just moved up to the Arctic, all the way up north for the first time. I went back after living in that negative host family situation because I wanted to sort of reclaim Norway for myself. And so I'd moved up to the Arctic to become a dog sledder, and I'd never been dog sledding before. And so this is the first time that I went out on, it wasn't a sled, it was a cart on wheels, because this is early in the fall.
Okay, let's hear it.
Okay. The dogs flowed, a perfect thrilling engine. Their legs stretched out like pistons. Their ears and tongues bounced in unison. Their running had nothing to do with me. They wouldn't have stopped if I'd asked them to. They were beautiful. They were so beautiful. I have never loved anything as hard and as fast as I loved those dogs, as I loved dog sledding itself. I could have watched them for hours. I could have watched them forever. They ran like water, and I was part of it, and I was struck with the instant and undeniable thought that I had finally come to the place that I had spent my life trying to find, right here. Of course it was here, in the Arctic, in Norway, between the gray mass of the fjord and the sharp snowy mountains at the top of the turning world. It was almost too much to acknowledge. It was hard to trust the fact of my body in this place, but here were the dogs, pulling me, proving it.
It's Blair Braverman reading from her memoir, Welcome to the GD Ice Cube, Chasing Fear, Finding Home in the Great White North.
So you're part of our Dog Days of Summer series, Blair. What is it that you know about dogs because of the way you work with them that, you know, that those of us who have them, who they live in our houses and we relate to them that way, have a different relationship? What's the thing you understand about them because of the way you work with them?
I think there's many things. And we have pets too, my fiance and I. So I am able to sort of track the differences. I think that the biggest thing about having a team of dogs is that instead of just interacting with the dog one-on-one and having that relationship, there's so many different relationships because all of the dogs have complicated relationships to each other, and you are part of that network. You're mixed in with all of it, and you see the dogs, making friendships and making rivalries and flirting with each other and having these shifting connections as their moods change. So it's this really interesting glimpse into a dog's mind, into a dog's connections that you just can't see if, you're not the minority. I think that the other thing, and maybe in some ways this is like people who have service dogs, I can't speak to that, but you are responsible for the dog's lives in fairly extreme situations, and they are responsible for you. And that is, I think that they understand that. I think that you have to build up so much trust for a dog to be a good sled dog for you. They won't just run. You know, they're not a machine. You don't turn the key. It's built entirely on your trust with them, on your communication with them, on knowing their needs and anticipating them. And then the amount of love you have for those dogs as a result is unlike any other love I've had with different kinds of animals, with pets.
So you're training for the Iditarod, is that right?
I am.
Okay, when does that happen? How much more training do you have?
Well, it's a multi-year process of qualifying.
Okay.
So right now, the rules are changing a little bit, but you need 700 miles of qualifying races. And then before that, you need to qualify for the qualifiers. So I'm a third of the way done with my qualifying races. I will finish the next ones this winter or the year after that. And I should be qualified for the Iditarod hopefully in 2018 or 2019.
I wish you so much luck on that. And I want to talk to you when you're in the Iditarod. I have no...
Okay.
I don't doubt you at all, Blair, after reading this
well,
memoir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Really great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
You too.